Welcome to Perspectives. I'm Joan Herman. On the show today, Washington, D.C.-based journalist and historian Chris Lehman joins me by telephone to discuss the pervasive influence of money on the American political system. Lehman is the editor of the provocative online left-wing newsletter, The Baffler, and author of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Lehman will be in Astoria on Wednesday, August 8th, for a conversation at the Lovell Showroom on how money influences American democracy and what each of us can do about it. The 7 p.m. event, sponsored by the progressive organization Indivisible North Coast Oregon, is free and open to the public. After I speak with Chris, Indivisible North Coast Oregon co-leader Lori Kaplan will explain what the group has been up to. But first, my interview with Chris Lehman. This program was pre-recorded. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks very much, Joan. It's great to be here. I just have one small correction. The Baffler is also a print publication, which I would be in big trouble with my publisher if I didn't.
Thank you for correcting
tell you
me.
That and encourage people to subscribe.
Yeah,
it
thank
makes
you.
It's a lovely gift.
Great. Thank you for the correction.
Sure thing.
And you are on vacation in New Hampshire, so I apologize for interrupting your vacation to discuss such a lovely subject. But
no problem. I mean, New Hampshire knows all about money.
Unfortunately. But seriously, you have done, from what I can tell, a good deal of research about the corrupting influence of money in politics. I'm curious what led you to research this subject so intensely.
Reality. I guess would be the short answer. I do think, we've seen over time a dramatic shift, obviously, in the wake of the 2010 Supreme Court ruling in Citizens United versus FEC in the role of money in politics. And, we have seen as a not solely as a result of Citizens United, but in tandem with that ruling and alongside, the galvanization of a definite economic oligarchy in the United States, a political system in which donors, big money donors, far outweigh the influence of ordinary citizens in the conduct of public life. There have been actual, political scientists have conducted studies that demonstrate, comparing the platforms of the two major parties alongside stated preferences of voters in opinion polls, and the divergence is really striking. But if you make the same analysis and look at, basically the economic and political agenda of the 1%, there is a very close congruence. As I said, reality, and also I'm just another citizen who is alarmed at the rapid transformation of our democracy into something else. And I think money is a crucial lens to begin to understand that transformation and to begin thinking about how we rectify it.
Well, and that's a good segue, because most of us don't have a lot of money, don't have seven-figure or greater incomes. So what can each of us do, or is there much we can do beyond voting? But even that, some can be cynical about whether it matters nowadays.
Indeed. I do think, you're seeing stirrings, particularly in the current Democratic primary season, of powerful grassroots campaigns that are dislodging the sort of establishment influence within the party. Definitely Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's victory in the 14th district in New York, where she unseated, I think a six-term incumbent who was the handpicked protege of Nancy Pelosi to run
yes.
the Democratic Party in Congress, is a bellwether. I think, the Bernie Sanders insurgent candidacy in the 2016 presidential primaries is also a bellwether. I think the governor's race in Michigan, where Abdul al-Fayed is mounting a really exciting underdog bid for the Democratic nomination, is also a bellwether. And I think what those three campaigns kind of share in common is a tremendous amount of energy and interest from younger voters. And it's interesting, you know, most sort of retrospective analyses of Obama's 2008 presidential victory indicate that the youth vote was really one of the decisive forces that propelled him into the White House. And I think it's, you know, obviously the 2016 presidential cycle was bitter, and there was a lot of, you know, I guess less than warm feelings between the Sanders and Clinton camps.
Yes.
But what was striking, in contrast to the 2008 example, in 2008, Obama represented, you know, this insurgence of interested young voters into the party, and the party figured out a way to embrace them. In 2016, I would argue the party establishment forcefully repelled those voters. And I think that's just at the simple level of tactical get-out-the-vote politics, it was a terrible mistake.
Yes.
You need to get, you know, as Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez says, for progressives on the left side of the spectrum, the swing voters are not red to blue voters. That is to say, you know, this sort of mainstream media myth that there's a persuadable piece of the Trump constituency that the Democrats can peel off.
Mm-hmm.
The swing voters that progressives need to target are non-voters and turn them into voters. And how mm-hmm. do you do that? You give them something to vote for. Obviously, you see slowly the Democratic establishment is much more receptive to proposals like single payer or Medicare uh-huh. for all that they reflexively dismiss as hopelessly utopian, you know, impractical, et cetera, up until 2016. So, you know, how you make a difference is, yes, you vote, but you also, you know, part of being an activist in any political party is to demand more of its leaders. And I think the Democratic Party has the dynamic by which the Democratic base can demand more of its leaders has been broken for a long time. And now I think progressive activists are figuring out need us, you know. And that's, I think, the way it's interest group politics. It's the way all politics in our country works.
Do you think the Democratic Party learned its lesson with the last presidential election, which really disenfranchised so many younger voters in particular?
I wish I could candidly say yes. I live in Washington. I interact and have interviewed many leaders of the Democratic Party, and the simple fact of the matter is, you know, speaking of money and politics, the national leaders of the Democratic Party have too much in terms of their livelihood and professional status at stake to change course. I think, you know, in real terms, the only way you get a new Democratic Party that's, you know, seriously competitive is to get rid of the existing leadership. And it's interesting in parliamentary democracies when a major party suffers, you know, the kind of thrashing that the Democrats did. I know Hillary won the popular vote, but taking the entire sort of elective scene into view, Democrats have their lowest influence in state houses, in Congress, state legislatures, et cetera, since 1924.
Wow.
But that's a crisis, in my view. So
yeah.
In a parliamentary system, when a party leadership delivers this kind of, you know, plainly unacceptable results, the leaders resign. I mean, sometimes it's a symbolic gesture, and the leaders just go off into the private sector and come back. But it's still a basic acknowledgement that we're responsible and we screwed up. And someone else needs to take charge.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that in our system, and that's why you have, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, in my view, behaving as though nothing is different, and that, you know, they just need to fine-tune basically what is a donor-driven Democratic agenda to get a better result. And they, you know, forget 2016 and 2010 and 2014. They lost standing in both that House and Senate. So, you know, these are people who have not delivered results. In the private sector, they'd be gone.
Yeah.
Not that that's the model, but I'm
right. Somebody who certainly has a lot of money, though we don't know how much, because he won't release his tax returns, is Donald Trump, the president.
Yeah.
Were you surprised when he was elected?
Oh, yes. I think, you know, I think he was surprised when he was elected.
That's what I've heard.
If you go by the account in Michael Wolff's book, yeah, I think it was, you know, the sort of thing that should be a wake-up call to everyone. And we've seen, you know, most of the disasters everyone on the left predicted would happen take place, you know, to the nth power since Trump has come into office. That's, you know, that is, to me, what's frustrating is I do feel, you know, again, just as a citizen of a country that I hope evolves back into a democracy, that this is a crisis. And I don't get a strong sense, at least from the Democratic establishment, that they have that same feeling.
Many Americans are concerned about what appears to be the president lining the pockets of his family members and his friends. Is this just more evidence of this, how money is so infiltrating every aspect of our democratic system?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, the mere fact that Donald Trump ever emerged as an implausible national leader is testament to the uncritical worship of wealth in our culture at large. This is, you know, someone who, you know, his entire being is clearly motivated only by the quest for greater and greater wealth, and he's denied since he's taken office. And I think, you know, the, there's currently a lawsuit to get the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which forbids the president from profiting from his office, recognized. So, and that's actually moving forward in a public court recently decided that, you know, there are sound legal grounds to pursue the suit. So, you know, I think Trump embodies, you know, what in my, you know, sort of wider historical research and writing I've described as the money cult in the title of my last book. And it's also why you see, you know, one of the seeming paradoxes of the Trump presidency is the stalwart evangelical support for a figure who has clearly, you know, conducted, you know, many alleged extramarital affairs, who his first wife alleged that he raped her. And, you know, just is far from a poster figure for family values conservatism.
So that's where I wanted to go next. Why do they support him so strongly? Because he would seem to be against everything that they believe in.
Well, first of all, there are scriptural rationales for flawed leaders like King David, who, you know, that's the sort of go-to kind of fundamentalist rationale for why they're so attracted to Trump. He's also given them key agenda items, including, you know, the Supreme Court appointment of Neil Gorsuch and the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, and he made Jerusalem, you know, declared that America recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which is a big theological matter of importance for a lot of evangelical believers. So he's a flawed human who's carrying out the will of the Lord and the view of many of these people. But the my broader point is Trump embodies a prosperity gospel outlook that has long, kind of quietly but very influentially come to dominate the mindset of many evangelical believers. Trump, when he was growing up, his father took him to worship at the church run by the Reverend Norman Vincent Peale, author of The Power of Positive Thinking, and Peale presided over Trump's first marriage. And Trump, embodies this kind of positive thinking, wealth-driven version of spirituality in America, and I think there's a deep recognition of that on the part of his evangelical supporters. He also, I think, generally appeals to conservatives because he plays this kind of bad boy role where he, taunts, liberals for being politically correct and, is kind of crude and confrontational. And that is kind of emotionally satisfying for a lot of people on, who are not the well-to-do donor class American right, but are feel kind of culturally excluded and discriminated against by liberalism.
So even though he has had several extramarital affairs, as you pointed out, including one not long after his wife Melania gave birth to their son, and has had other indiscretions, at least alleged indiscretions, it would seem surprising that they still would get behind him.
Obvious, if you're going to castigate them for hypocrisy, right, many of these same voters were, keen to impeach Bill Clinton for the Monica Lewinsky affair. Mm-hmm. And yes, it is, from a secular point of view, it's super critical, but as I was saying, they have this kind of very selective and I don't think scripturally sound faith that, God chooses a broken vessel to carry out his will. But that is a key way to rationalize Trump's conduct.
Okay. Yeah. And I have not read your book, but I've read snippets of it and heard interviews of you. You talk about the prosperity gospel as something that goes back to really the beginnings of way before we were even a nation. We've only got a couple minutes left, but could you just say a little bit more about that? In two minutes.
I feel like this is a poetry race or something. I'll give it my best shot.
No, no pressure.
Right. Well, America has always had this powerful, ever since the Puritan settlement of New England, has had a powerful kind of folk strain of belief in which, often wealth has been literally worshipped. Someone like Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, was a money digger up in New England prior to his discovering the Mormon scripture in upstate New York. And money has often been given this kind of spiritual power, both among Protestant believers in America and in the culture at large. And that, in my view, is a fascinating process whereby denominations like Mormonism and Pentecostalism in America begin as faith of kind of outcasts and economically downtrodden figures and then evolve over time into the worship, the idea that God rewards virtue with money and blessing. And there's all kinds of problems theologically with that point of view, because if God is rewarding the wealthy, he must be punishing the poor, right?
And, right.
There are many, many stretches of the New Testament, beginning with the parable that it's easier for a camel to pass through an eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. That contradicts that view.
Yes.
But as with the case with supportive President Trump, these thinkers who are very much at the forefront of modern Protestant faith in America are very resourceful and selective in their reading of scripture.
Yes.
That's the short version. Well, read the book for the cult.
Yes, definitely. The Money Cult. Well, thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate you breaking up your vacation to speak with us from New Hampshire.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Chris Lehman will be in Astoria this coming Wednesday to participate in a discussion about the influence of money on the American democratic system and what each of us can do about it. Indivisible North Coast Oregon is sponsoring the event, which begins at 7 p.m. at the Fort George Lovell Showroom at 14th and Duane Streets downtown. The event is free and open to the public. I'm Joan Herman on Perspectives on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 FM Astoria and 89.5 Tillamook. I apologize for the poor sound quality of the interview with Chris Lehman. Here in the studio now is Indivisible North Coast Oregon co-leader Lori Kaplan, who will talk a bit about what the Progressive Grassroots Organization is up to. Welcome to the studio, Lori.
Hey, Joan. Thank you.
Why don't you start by explaining, for those who aren't familiar with Indivisible, what it is?
Indivisible North Coast Oregon is one of about 5,000 groups that sprang up in response to the 2016 presidential election. And we're not, we're in touch with each other. We're like a network more than an organized top-down follow orders kind of structure. So our local group covers all of Clatsop County, the Washington Peninsula, and we even go into a little bit of Tillamook County down to Manzanita and thereabouts. And our mission, which we formed ourselves, is to defend democracy against authoritarianism, bigotry, and corruption. So in the year and a half, 2 years, not quite 2 years, that we've been together as a group, we've created community groups in Manzanita, Cannon Beach, Seaside, Gearhart, Warrenton, Astoria, and across the river. I think that's all five. And as well, we've had different focuses for action. So we've had, we do have a Vote the Future team and an events team and an opposed bigotry team. But we're not quite as rigid as that sounds, so everybody kind of overlaps and takes part. And leadership is self-selected. Membership is self-selected. So anyone who wants to defend democracy with us is welcome to attend and participate. We don't check for political party affiliation. It's really about loving our country. It's about patriotism and wanting to keep our democracy strong and healthy. And so that's the global. And then we can talk about what we do locally. We do a lot of voter registration, getting out the vote. We're reaching out to communities and to people who may not know we're here as often as we can. And thank you for giving us this opportunity today.
Of course.
And we're hosting Chris, and we have another exciting event for under 40-ish kinds of people on Wednesday as well. We encourage people to run for office. We encourage people to participate in political campaigns. We encourage all kinds of civic engagement. And each of the community groups kind of does their own thing. They figure out what matters to those people. The Astoria Community Group has been writing a group letter to the editor every month at our meeting. Other groups just do different things, and it's all what keeps us strong because it's embracing all kinds of perspectives. And many of your listeners might have seen us in action last Saturday. We were at 16th and Marine Drive supporting the rally to defeat Measure 105, which is really a measure that will increase racial profiling, and it seems to me incredibly anti-democratic.
And is that the measure that would end Oregon's sanctuary state status?
Yeah, that is Measure 105. It will be on the ballot in November. It's being promoted by at least one group that's been identified by the Southern Poverty Law Center as the worst hate group in Oregon.
What group is that?
Oh, please, I don't. That's okay. I don't have the name, but it sounds really like a nice group until you know what they're right. actually doing. And we were really privileged to work with Lower Columbia Hispanic Council on Saturday's rally, and that's one of the things we want to do. We don't want to duplicate work that other groups are doing. We want to work with them and have partnerships. So that's what we got to do Saturday.
How can people learn more if they want to, for example, find out about the 40 and under group on Wednesday? Where would they go to get the details? Okay.
Well, I can tell you right now about 40 and under group, because that actually we're hosting just an informal session right before Chris's presentation. This one starts at 6 o'clock when the doors open at the Lovell Showroom on Wednesday the 8th. And it's geared for just people who are already juggling 97 million things in their lives already, but want to perhaps learn more about democracy or participate more in defending democracy with Indivisible. So, and we have a kids' corner, so parents can take part in the discussion without having to worry about their kids. And there'll be stuff for the kids to do, too. So people can find out about Indivisible North Coast Oregon. Just if you Google that, or if you put in IndivisibleNorthCoastOregon.org, O-R-G, on your search engine, then you can find us.
And there's have a website.
We have a website that lists a whole bunch of tabs at the top, and one of them is events, and our newsletter is also posted there. But it's even better if you get our emails, which is a weekly newsletter with all kinds of information and events. And you can do that by signing up. When you go to the website, on the right-hand side, it says sign up. So if you sign up there, and we can also connect you with your community group. And we also have a closed Facebook group where there's a ton of information as well and discussion. So it's more of a back and forth like Facebook's can be.
So somebody would just, if they're on Facebook, just request to join.
That's it. Exactly.
Okay. Well, that's great. Great information. Well, we are pretty much out of time. I want to thank my guest, Lori Kaplan, for coming into the studio to speak about the progressive grassroots organization, Indivisible North Coast Oregon. Thank you, Lori.
Thanks, Joan.
Earlier, you heard an interview with Washington, D.C.-based journalist and historian Chris Sleeman, who will be in Astoria on Wednesday, August 8th, to take part in a discussion entitled Prosperity in Politics with his sister, Deb Vanas, who co-chairs Indivisible North Coast Oregon with Lori Kaplan. The 900-member group is a grassroots progressive organization throughout Clatsop and Pacific counties, primarily. The event begins at 7 at the Fort George Lovell Showroom at 14th and Duane Streets downtown and is free and open to the public. This is Perspectives, and I'm your host, Joan Herman. The show is brought to you in part by a grant from the Clatsop County Cultural Coalition. Perspectives was engineered today by Gabe White. The show can be heard on the stations of Coast Community Radio, 91.9 Astoria, and 89.5 Tillamook. You also can find show podcasts on the station's website. If you would like to contact me, send me an email to perspectives@coastradio.org. Thanks for listening.